All right, so we have an exciting program tonight. This is the final Tuesday forum that we have been hosting as a part of this larger exhibit called Windows and Mirrors, Reflections on the War in Afghanistan. And before I introduce the panel this evening, I just want to give you some background on the exhibit. This is something that is organized by the American Friends Service Committee, and it's something we've been working on for a long time. Back in January of last year, we approached the Chicago Art Alliance and the Philadelphia Mural Alliance program to ask them to help us reach artists who might be willing to produce murals that would depict the images of the war in Afghanistan. And at the time, we said we were hoping for 50, and everyone kind of thought, well, you'll never get 50. But we did end up receiving 45 murals. And as you look around and as you listen to the speakers this evening, we very much want the war in Afghanistan to be on your mind and to be thinking about what's happening there. We gave very few guidelines to the artists, simply asking them to create an image that they have of the war. And so you'll notice some of them are positive, some are images of what an Afghan childhood might look like without war, and of course some are very graphic and depict the actual cost of war. So this evening, 2 weeks ago, we've done three forums. Our first forum was on alternatives, and we had some speakers come and talk to us about alternatives that existed in 2001 after 9/11 and the criminal attacks on the United States, and alternatives that still exist now that are non-military. And then last week, we had a panel on Islam and Islamophobia. And we were looking at the impact of 9 years of war, a war on terror that is so often identified with the Muslim community. And we were given some ways to change that and some projects that we could support. This evening, we're looking at the concept of restorative justice at home and abroad. And the idea was that as we think about the violence of war and the alternatives to war, what about the violence that's taking place in communities in the United States, and what are some of the alternatives that groups and individuals and organizations are designing to change that? And so, here's the framework. When looking at the violence of war or communities in the United States, there is a school of thought that says the government, through the military or police, needs to remove the bad guys to impose order. In U.S. cities, it has been through incarceration. In international relations, through war. These policies promote a belief that places sole moral blame on the perpetrators and the communities from which they come. By understanding root causes, identifying and taking steps to repair harm, and involving all parties, communities affected by violence are pioneering new ways to promote healing. These healing practices, sometimes called restorative justice, have helped to reduce or eliminate subsequent violence in numerous communities. And that's what we're going to talk about this evening. We'll have a number of panelists that will share their stories with you. We'll start with King Downing, who's a colleague of mine at the American Friends Service Committee. He's also the former director of the Racial Profiling Project at the American Civil Liberties Union. And he'll be setting up some framework for us to think about. I'll next introduce Robin Busman with the Philadelphia Mural Arts Program, who will introduce four of the gentlemen that she works with. The format following these presentations is that we're going to have some questions and answers among with the moderator and the speakers, and then we're going to break the audience into pieces and have a guided discussion with each of our panelists. We'll be joining you. That we're hoping will stimulate some interesting questions and conversation. We'll then break out and bring everybody back up to the front, and we'll kind of have an open mic discussion with all of the panelists. So we're hoping that it will be an exciting and interesting evening for you. We'll start with King Downey.
Are you clapping because I managed to get here with the crutches? We were talking basketball a little earlier, and I explained to them that I'm still trying to maintain my game, but I didn't do so well this time. I took a spill. But it's great to be here, and I want to thank the organizers of the event. Let's give them a round of applause. And I also want to thank the creators of this great artwork, because this is my first time here. I saw it all online, but the way it hits you when you're really here. So let's give them a round of applause, too. And then the last one is I'd like to give you all a round of applause, because you might have been watching the Miami Heat game tonight. It's okay. So give yourselves a round of applause also. Now, we sort of tricked you in bringing you here today, because we lured you in with a lot of artwork, so we wanted you to have cultural enjoyment and, you know, seeing colors and a message, but we didn't tell you that we also brought you in here to do a little bit of work, because the problems of violence in our communities here and the problem of violence overseas is serious. And my theory, and this is what we're going to talk about today, is that it's going to be something that can only be solved when we all put our heads together. It's not going to be the experts. It's going to be folks like you and me. And we're going to be the ones that decide we've had enough of the way things aren't going right, and that we've had enough of not seeing the things that we want to see. And that's what our focus is at the AFSC's Healing Justice Program. We're really working on three things. The first is we're trying to end punitive criminal justice practices, or healing justice as we refer to them. Second, we're trying to increase the reliance on restoring and healing and building rather than punishing and locking away. And the third is that we want to deal with the racial issues that have come out of this process, this problem. So we're going to put our heads together today, and we're going to talk about those four axes of problems. That on one hand, we're seeing a lot of violence with our communities here. On the other hand, we're seeing a lot of blame being placed for that violence, but is that blame really being stretched to fit all who should share that blame? On the other hand, we're hearing much about war and about the violence that's taking place on the ground in these places, and some pretty bad things have been said about some of those people. But are they entirely to blame for the problem themselves? So let's start with here, and I have some sheets that I'd like you all to take a look at. One thing, first of all, it saves me from having to say a lot. And what it is it's a chart that kind of lays out the way it all seems for me. And the purpose of our meeting today is that this is a draft, and I meant to put draft on the top of it, because this is a document that can be approved or changed or scrapped by all of us in our conversation today. So I'd like, if there's enough of these folks over here, to get them too. So if you look at the side that says U.S. communities, you know, what's the picture right now? I think there were, in 2009, there were 12 million, I believe there were $12 billion worth of crimes that were committed in the United States. This is street crimes. Untold amounts of violence, murders, lost property. It's so serious that you can't you can't turn on the news anywhere and not see some kind of description of the violence and pictures of young men, mostly men of color, being taken off to jail and pictures of other young men lying in the streets. And it's a serious problem. And so I'm going to walk through it and give you some food for thought. And you notice that we're going to be doing some work, because you'll see at the bottom of the side that says U.S. Communities, I've left two rows of six boxes. Why do you think those are blank? Take a guess. What's that? Right. We're going to go into the groups, and we're going to see if there are any changes that could be made here or anything that would be added. So the columns are violent behavior, community moral legal violation, government moral legal violation, government aberrant violent behavior. Somebody give a definition of aberrant. I don't know if everybody might know what that means. Aberrant. I heard you say outside of the norm. What was the first word?
Negatively
outside of the norm. And then finally, government-sanctioned violence. And so most of the time when we hear about the violence in our communities, a lot of the focus is on the first column, describing the violence. Youth, young adults, gangs, street crime. We're very familiar with that. You move to the second column, you're probably pretty familiar with that, too, where there are discussions within the community and also in the major media about the causes. Well, the youth have a lack of a personal moral code. They don't know how to act. Well, they don't know how to act, but their parents are failing to teach them morality and failing to discipline them. And on top of that, the community is not taking appropriate action to guide these youth and adults as well. And then there are even arguments that accuse the groups who were involved were usually so-called racial minorities, and somehow blaming them for having some kind of a lack of moral fiber or cultural fiber, and even implying that it's inherent within their racial makeup. And the conversation pretty much stops there. Now, the three columns that I'm adding are to say, well, if we can say that youth who are relatively powerless in this society, and if we can say that parents who are relatively powerless in this society have all this moral responsibility, and if communities that have a lack of resources have all this moral responsibility, what about the government, which has all the resources and everything in its pockets? Does it have any moral responsibility or legal responsibility as well? And that's when we move to the next column. The general failure to eradicate poverty, failure to fund schools, jobs and training, childcare, recreational facilities, all of which would have a positive contribution to the moral fiber that affects this youth violence and young adult violence. Allowing manufacturing jobs to go overseas. And you'll see I added little footnotes. This is a work in progress, and I'm hoping that you all may be able to give me some sources for this information that I can add. So, for example, and I'm not going to go through all the footnotes, but manufacturing jobs overseas was made real in the gang context by Mike Davis, who wrote City of Quartz. And there he talks about how the Bloods and the Crips were gangbangers, but they were gangbangers from, say, age 12, 13, 14, 15, until about 19 or 20. And in the old days, something different began to happen. They began to get into relationships. They began to have kids. They began to want to raise families. So instead of being out on the streets in petty games and petty fights, what they did was they went into the manufacturing sector and they started getting jobs in some of the factories in L.A. And they let their gang affiliations go because they were beginning to raise families, make money, go towards buying a home and doing all the things that people do. Well, when those 12 major economic sectors left Los Angeles, all of a sudden there were no more jobs. And so when people got to the age of moving out of the gang situations and getting into real life, there was no place to go. So all of a sudden, Bloods and Crips were now affiliated at the age of 22, 25, 30, 35, even 40 years old, still trying to make a living off the streets. So that's a serious contribution that doesn't get mentioned in the context of gang violence. Just kind of say, oh, yeah, jobs overseas. And I'll go through the rest quickly. Racial profiling, a double standard. Tough on street crime, easy on corporate crime. Any examples of corporate crime? Let's go by decade. What's the most recent?
The oil spill. Wall Street.
What about Wall Street?
Well, the near failure of the banks that is right at the feet of
Wall Street greed, no consequence, bonuses.
Are we describing criminal activities?
I think so.
And the Village Voice has an article that says that that $13 trillion didn't vanish in thin air. It ended up in someone's pocket. And this Village Voice article says that that money is in overseas accounts and it's laying low because if it got introduced into the community now, we would have crazy inflation. So this focus on corporate crime versus easy crime, versus easiness on corporate crime is a major contribution to the problem here. And so young men are being brought into prison and in jail. And then the last one, which is really the big one, military war spending and corporate welfare. And I know that there's a sheet that the peace programs put out that talk about if the money hadn't been spent on the war, what could be done with it. And I think it covers almost every area here, schools, jobs, childcare, recreational facilities. If the $100 million a day that's being spent in Afghanistan was spent in the communities, do you think we would be seeing the same level of violence that we'd be seeing? So now let's move on to the next column, government aberrant behavior. Now that's behavior that the government doesn't sanction. That's violence that the government doesn't sanction, but occurs anyway. Police and prison guard brutality, violent and indiscriminate gang and drug raids. And there's a book there called Overkill, by Radley Balco from the conservative Cato Institute, talking about the militarization of police and the number of raids that are going into communities of color and how the massive violence to justify all the military equipment they're getting is a boom industry for defense contractors, but it also has consequences in the community. And then on the last corner is violence that's sanctioned by the government. Because the first column is places where, we went over the limit, we kind of broke the rules. But we get in the last column, shoot to kill orders. Governor Blanco in Louisiana saying we have orders to shoot to kill looters. Okay, that was government sanctioned, and the New Orleans Police Department carried that order out in full, and we still don't know how many people were killed. And only the first 18 have been indicted most recently for blatant shootings that took place. Failure to prosecute police and prison guard brutality and sanctioned torture in prison. And the footnote there refers to the prison inside the prison, which AFSC's Stop Max campaign put out documenting this solitary confinement and torture and isolation that is legally sanctioned by the prisons and has a serious effect on people when they come out and their inability to reenter. And then finally, the death penalty, legally sanctioned violence. Now, on the other side, turn to Afghanistan. We have the same columns. We have sectarian insurgent violence. And one of our panelists had, and I'm going to put him on the spot a little bit, because he saw this in the news and looked up the word insurgent. And what did you find?
Found that it was actually a form of a type of civilian, like women and children and dogs and cats and things like that. It's a type of how he's sitting right now.
Any PETA members here? Because he mentioned dogs and cats, and I hadn't included them in mine, but I'm going to make sure I put them in. So insurgent violence, he's saying, is civilian violence, sectarian violence between groups of civilians, shootings, bombings, kidnappings, suicide attacks. We know all about those. The news is full of those. It's covering those, right? And that's a horrible way of having life be carried out, to be exposed to these things and to be victims of this. And then we're hearing a lot in the media and conversations about the morality of the people who are carrying this out. And their claim that they're inferior as to their religion, as to their ethnicity, their race, even their culture. Their culture is violent. This is the way they are. And their nation is violent. That's the way their nation is. There's no doubt that there's a place for that personal morality to be applied, but the story stops. That's why I have the double lines there. Are there any government, moral and legal violations of a similar type that are occurring over there in Afghanistan? Well, first, you have a military occupation of a country by the U.S., for which there's no legal basis. Then you have the U.S. government's failure to provide economic development, education, clean water, and a host of other things, which would probably alleviate the conditions that are causing the sectarian violence. Then you, as I mentioned earlier, $100 million a day being spent on the Afghan war. And this footnote refers to the report card, the AFSC report card, which is online, which is a nice way that all of this, the U.S.'s actions over there get created. Violation of human rights, all of the tensions that are going on, racially disproportionate actions that are taken, Afghan government corruption, which the Corruption Perception Index says is the second most corrupt government in the world. And by the way, the U.S. has almost slipped out of the top 20. It's now ranked 19. So we're also on that slippery slope. So the last two columns, and then I'll be done. Government aberrant behavior. The U.S. killings of civilians by rogue soldiers. This is something that the U.S. condemns, but at the same time it's going on. Arbitrary arrests and detentions by everybody over there. U.S., NATO, police, government security, government-backed private militias are all behaving violently in violation of their own rules. The night raids, the torture and deaths, I gave examples with footnotes of Kandahar and Bagram. And it's not just aberrant behavior, because when you look in the media, every once in a while, the answer will be, well, yes, but some soldiers got out of line, some people, you know, went off of the rules of engagement. But it turns out that in the last column, there's plenty there, that a lot of the violence is sanctioned by our government. Aggressive military tactics, the killing of civilians, air and drone bombings, those aren't accidents. It's part of the calculation that people are going to lose their lives when drones are able to drop bombs in civilian areas. Authorized torture, it's another round of sanctioned violence, and the failure to prosecute the U.S. Army or any of the other forces, including the Afghan forces, for this. So here's a chart, and this is a start, because some of these may not belong here. There may be others that we can add when we sit down and put our heads together. But our goal is to really get to the bottom of this. And anybody remember Stokely Carmichael? Anybody remember SNCC? SNCC, what did SNCC stand for? Oh, I got a lot of answers. Usually it's one or two. Well, Stokely was one of the founders of SNCC. And he said, what, probably 40 years ago today, he said, the time is past description. The time is now for prescription. Let's stop talking about it. What are we going to do about it? We have more facts than we need to get busy. So that's what we're going to do when we get into these groups. So this is a little working sheet. I left some boxes. We'll get into our conversations, and we'll see if there's anything else that got missing here. And the last row is for the plan of action. Okay.
All right, before you can start working on these charts, we're going to hear some testimonies from the community-centered perspective. And I want Robin Buseman to say a little bit about the Murology Program and introduce our next guests.
Thank you. We run a program at Mural Arts, Restorative Justice Program. It's called The Guild, and we work with young men and some women involved in the criminal justice system, and it's all centered around the concept that people can redeem themselves and that for acts that they might have done. But generally, it's built on relationships and built on bringing out the best of the people that we work with. And I'm very fortunate to have four great young men here with me tonight who I know very well, and have worked with two of them for 9 months and the other two for a few months. But they're in the Guild program, and they learn about art, they learn about construction, they learn about scaffolding, forklifts. We're trying to develop job skills, interests. We took a tour of community college, trying to figure out where they want to go in a positive way. And we're very happy that Marcus and Paul graduated last week at City Hall with the deputy mayor. Gave them their certificates. It's an exciting program. They're both, even though they graduated, they're both still working with us because we're just not going to throw them, you know, out the door, because we want to make sure they transition into something. But they're extraordinary young men, and They're going to talk a little bit about their experience in Philadelphia, what their lives are like, and then hopefully they can jump off to some discussions. My background is, I've been in the criminal justice field since the early 70s, and remember the AFSC books we used to read at Berkeley, at the School of Criminology, so it's really exciting to be here. I'm really thankful for AFSC and what the work they've done in the criminal justice field. I mean, it's phenomenal, so happy to be here. So Marcus is going to go first.
How everybody doing tonight? I want to talk about some more violent behavior that goes on in my community, as far as like greed, envy, and hatred and stuff like that. I also like to add that to the list. As far as like the behavior wise, it's like sometimes you can't really see it. Like you can't really tell what's going on. Like you really like these are people that could be your friends, your family, whoever. Like. Who could talk to you as if they was your friend, dang, man, you look like you getting money or you got them fresh sneakers on and stuff like that. Like, certain stuff you need to watch out for or look out for. Getting to the point where as though, some people in the world, everybody don't think the same. They could be plotting, as far as they want to get what you got. They want to be you. This stuff that I deal with in my community, it's crazy because I'm not the type of person that, I don't do stuff like that. I'm not into that kind of stuff. I work with Robin every day at the Mirror Arts program. That's what I do. That's what I like to do. And as far as, the government, George Bush. I'm not a fan of George Bush. I never was, really. I think that a lot of the stuff that we're going through today is because of George Bush. As far as, the government not having money, I feel like he lied to us about a lot of stuff that was going on as far as Osama bin Laden. I don't even believe in him. I don't even think that he exists, honestly. That's just my opinion, though. He was somebody that existed at first, and then after a while, what happened to him? You know what I'm saying? It's a lot of questions I want to ask. But, I don't know, maybe I could get to do it one day. But that's about it. That's all I really got to talk about right now.
Good. Thank you. Yeah, we were talking about where is George Bush now? We're going to go look for him. We're going to make a movie about it. All right, Jerome is next.
How you doing? My name is Jerome Day. I'm here. This basically, I want to touch four basics words on my community. Now, most people sit there, they walk around and they look at violence as people, they don't know why people do violence. And I understand that, I understand why people don't know why violence and where violence come from. But my understanding is violence comes from the lack of communication, understanding, and bad security. All right, well, the reason why I say the lack of communication, because if you can't talk to me, respond to me in the way that I can handle, if you yelling at me, how you going to get your point across? There's two people yelling, how can you get your point across? I'm not understanding you, you're not understanding me. So communication is a big key. So it's like, if you can conversate or talk to a person better, then you'll have a better understanding. And also when I say about security, because most people nowadays for years, kids been having kids. So it's like, if you're in a home where you have a mother that chooses her boyfriend over you, or she does not dare, she working two jobs, whatever the situation may be, and you get into something, who do you have to run to? You don't have nobody. You don't have nobody to sit there and stand up for yourself. So that's why most people sit there, they fight. pick the wrong crowd, pick up a gun, use drugs. But the most important thing is we need to have more knowledge. Because people have small imaginations around here, around this community. The first thing they go to do and think of when it comes to making money is selling drugs. And that's kind of bad. That's kind of sad, too, actually. You want to give somebody knowledge to the point that they can look up and sit there and say, well, I know I do this, I can do that. I'm polymath. I'm a person with many talents, so I can sit there and do it. Like, I'm a person with many talents. There's nothing in my eyes that I can't do. But if it's like taking care of a child. If you don't teach that child nothing, what do that child know? And then once you grow up, and then all you think about is like, all right, you sitting there saying, you about to have a baby, you 19, and you don't know nothing. So you have the lack of knowledge, and you don't know nothing, and you need a job, and you need some type of income to support you and your family. Most people ain't going to sit there and think about going to jobs, because most people is lazy. You know what I mean? Most people don't have the understanding of getting up every day and seeking, working hard to find out the situations and to be a good provider. And I talk about the one thing I want to say about the law enforcement in Philadelphia, so. I would sit there and say, you got your bad and your good about it. I mean, you have your people here, they always there to help you, and they sit there and they try to be as best as they possibly can, but if you sitting there just pulling me over because you don't have nothing to do or because somebody is a certain color, that's not justice. You're here to serve, you're here to protect me. That's what a police officer is here to do, protect and serve. Now how can you protect me if you're the one that's harming me? Like, who can I run to? So if I'm a person with no knowledge, no understanding, no way, no person or way to communicate to a person, where do I go? And that's why I look at that picture right there, one with it like a person with a hoodie on. For some reason, that picture caught my eye as soon as I came in here, because it's like that person is alone, and all of the around it, that blood dripping down is all of it around it is basically violence. And who's there? That person looks sad, misguided, confused, everything. So it's like, that's how I look at it as the streets is. I mean, it's kind of bad, but it's sad. And only way I can sit there and say is, the way can make it better is communication, knowledge, understanding, and basically security, having a strong backbone. And basically that's my perception and my concept of Philadelphia and street violence. Thank you.
That was very good. That picture, that's really good. Thanks, Jerome. All right, Raheem.
Good evening, everyone. Once again, my name is Raheem. I kind of have a testimony. Now, violence, I'm from West Philadelphia. Around my area is just, it's not as bad as it used to be, but it's still bad. It could be a lot better. And a lot of violence comes from, you know, as being young, you don't have your parents with you. You don't have no one to guide you right and things of that nature. So, like, if you don't have, like, the proper guidance, it will lead you somewhere else. Like, as I was younger, my mom, she was on drugs and things like that. So, you know, I used to go to sleep. She'd steal my money out of my pocket and stuff like that. So, you know, I'm like, after a while, I get tired of it. So I'm going to go find a way to make my own money. So the only way I could think of it then, I was young, I ran to the streets. You know, I sold my little drugs here and there. You know, it's consequences behind everything you do. And I learned it. So, like, this is a testimony for me because, you know, after a while, I got arrested a couple times for it. About January, I came home. I did 8 months for drugs. And I say that's good for me. It helped me out in a huge way because now I'm not into the streets no more. Like, And I think Moral Arts and Rob Abusement for actually inviting me in, because without them, I probably been still on the streets doing the same thing I was doing. And with them, like, it's a lot of help. And I really thank Moral Arts for everything. Like, that's pretty much, that's all I really have to say. Like, this is just really a good testimony for me, because now I'm actually, you know, raising my daughter. She's 2 years old now. I'm actually raising it, and I'm not on the streets, and I'm not one of statistics where they call you a deadbeat daddy. So, you know, I'm just happy. I just thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
I think writing had a lot to do with him being successful, and it's, I always say it's what's inside of them that makes them successful. We can do all we want to people, but if it doesn't come from within, it's, you know, it's not successful. I think some of them have spoken about that too. But okay, so Paul is our last speaker.
How y'all ladies doing today, ladies and gentlemen? My name is Paul Jackson, and believe it or not, unlike the other gentlemen over here, my story is actually a little bit harsher than theirs are. Like he was talking about the Blood and the Crips, believe it or not, I'm actually one of the members of actually Blood gang. I've been a Blood since the age of probably like 10 or 11. It was basically a choice that I had to make. I was young. I was, you know, going through a lot of things. My mom was on drugs, you know, my stepfather, my father was never there. My father has never been there through my whole life. So it was just basically looking for what, you know, my coworker Jerome said, security. And I went to, I mean, the streets for it. And it turned out not too good. I spent almost about 6 years of my life in jail. And I'm actually thankful for Mural Arts also, because they gave me basically a second chance and a look back on life. And it's a big change. Like, I'm learning everything. I know how to build a house from the ground floor up. I know how to rewire a house. I know how to, you know what I mean, build a scaffold. I know how to paint murals, repair walls. I mean, I have a lot of business trades and a lot of things that, you know, can offer anything. So it's just like, you know, my community, and believe it or not, I'm actually not from Philadelphia. I didn't come here to Philadelphia until about maybe like, I think it was like 99 I came here to Philadelphia. I'm actually from Manassas, Virginia, which is down south. So it was actually hard down there, too. It was a lot of struggle down there. And it's actually, you know, it was a lot of places down there where Bloods were big down there, and, you know, it was just different. But believe it or not, I'm from West Philadelphia right now, and, you know, it's not as bad as Raheem said, it's not as bad as it used to be. But when I was growing up, and I mean, I still live in the projects, it's actually, you know, worse than most people, you mean, play it out to be, but then it can be better. Mostly because of the police officers that are there. Like, police officers, ever since I came to Philadelphia, they've been hounding me, and, you know, just because, you know, from where I was from, how I was raised, we were taught to, you know, represent who we were, wear our flags proudly. And when I came to Philadelphia, I found out that, you know, that's not a really good way to do things. And they actually harassed me. I've, you know, been beaten up a couple times by the police officers. You know, they told me that I could have filed trials and, you know, things like that. I'm truth be told, I'm an impatient type of person. So all of the court systems and things like that, I really don't like court. So, you know, most of the things I did, I knew it was me, so I just took it. And now it's a big change. I look back at it, and I'm actually, you know, upset at myself that I took that route. But even at that Jerome said again, communication, you know, it's big. If I had that, you know, that father figure, or, you know, that mother figure, or things like that, it would have been different. Or even if my community was involved, it still would have been different. You know, it's, and that's my story, you know.
You've got the program mic linked to this boom. Is that correct? So if we take this mic, do we lose? Your audio. No, because I can do it. I can do it another way. I want to give him another round because I really appreciate it that you all open up and told your stories in that way. Yeah. They made it look easy, but it's not as easy as it looks. Not at all. So what I want to do is just kick the conversation off a little bit and just ask each of you all a follow-up question. But because we want the mic here and we want you to get on camera, after I ask it, if each of you could come up and then answer it. And in no particular order, I was thinking about when, Raheem, you were saying that there was very little guidance and that your mom was on drugs. And one of the issues that has come up time and time again in the community is that there's a lack of drug treatment centers that are available for people who want to have help. So I'm asking a question that's kind of personal, and if you don't, if you're not comfortable answering it, it'd be all right. But the thing would be to just tell us if you think the situation would have been different if your mother or other mothers who were in that same situation were able to get drug treatment. Might that have an effect on your life? Yeah.
Well, I do think it would be a little different. Like, my father, I really didn't have my father too much in my life. I just actually recently started having my father about 5 years ago. And I think my mom was there for me to actually talk to her and things like that instead of her stealing from me. Like, I would actually have, wouldn't really have to worry about the streets too much to worry about go selling drugs. Because if I had my mom, then I wouldn't have to worry about her when I'm asleep, going in my pockets, stealing money or hiding money from my mom. So I believe if she was, like, really there and I had her to talk to and things like that, then I would never really have to actually turn to the streets to get money and things like that.
Thanks.
Thanks, Pam.
And I wanted to ask Marcus, because you started on the road when you said that you felt that George Bush was the problem. Now, we're not bashing an individual, but I'm sure that there were certain details that you had in mind when you thought of that. So could you share those with us?
First of all, I've been doing a lot of my own research with George Bush, and I've been like listening to a lot of his talks and stuff like that. As far as I'm talking about Osama bin Laden, and people asking like, "So what's up with Osama? Like, we didn't hear about you talk about him in like 9-8 months or whatever." Well, he's not the big problem right now. He's not the issue right now. We just want to talk about what's the guy he executed? Saddam Hussein. He just wanted to talk about Saddam Hussein. And a lot of this, like, recession stuff that we got going on right now, like, there's no money. Like, as far as the war go, like, I think that George Bush, like, a lot of this stuff, like, as far as the World Trade Center, like, about, like, the planes crashing and stuff like that. Like, there's a couple survivors and stuff like that. A lot of people saying that they actually heard bombs going off inside of the building. As far as that go, like, before the planes even hit the building. Understand? Like, I've been looking at a lot of stuff, like, mostly on the internet and going, like, looking at stuff like that.
Let me ask another question on it, because, so I see he's a budding member of the Truth Out movement.
Yes.
The 9/11 Truth Movement. So, when you said a recession, what effect does a recession in your mind have on the community, and does that have an effect on violence in the community?
I think it has a big effect because it's like, as far as prices on everything right now, it's like high, real high. Meaning that like in neighborhoods like mine, like it's to the point where we already don't have that much. And like, it's like young people, as far as like when you ask them this question or whatever, as far as like him growing up, like we don't have guidance, and like the only time, like we don't want to be to the point where we're like 30 years old and we finally know that we know what we want to do in life. Like we need that when we're young, and our parents is the people that can't give it to us. Like, I mean, like if your parents can't give you that guidance when you're young, then what you gonna do when you get older, when it's too late? You know what I'm saying? Like it. I know. I'm sorry, cause I'm talking off.
Like, no. You're right on it.
All right. Well, like when it's too late, and like what can we do? You know what I'm saying? And what moves can we make as far as us surviving? Like we have an understanding, like oh, we need a job, we need this, we need that. We don't even have no education. Understand? Because some of us turn to the streets. And we be in the streets all the time, 24/7, because we know that when we go home, our moms is not gonna have no food on the table. We not gonna have what we need at home. So that's why a lot of us turn to the streets, and it's messed up. And like when you finally realize, oh, I need my education, or I gotta go to school, but you too busy doing other stuff. But you young and you really don't realize it that much. But you just think that that's the right thing to do because that's the only way that you're gonna eat. That's the only way you can eat.
Makes sense.
Maybe. Questions.
All right, and I want to ask Paul. Paul, you said you spent 6 years in jail. You spent 6 years in jail.
Almost 6 years of my life.
6 years. So I had two questions for you. The first one was, did you learn any negative things in jail, and did you learn any positive things in jail?
Actually, truth be told, in those times of being incarcerated, I actually didn't learn too much. I learned a lot of positive stuff, but even at that, like, it was mostly, you know, hearsay. Like, I was, I mean, it wasn't really too many older people in there, you know, like, about 2001, I was put in a placement. It was called Grove City. It was called George Junior Republic. It was mostly for, you know, people in the age bracket of, like, I think, like, 12 to, like, 22, I think it was. And it wasn't really no, you know, older people in there. You know, the people in there really didn't care about none of the kids in there. They were just, you know, feeding them and doing everything like that. So it was a lot of fights. And even at that, I mean, I was the type growing up. By me knowing a lot of things from the streets, I was more so, I'm going to just do this for me. I'm not listening to nobody. Nobody knows me. It's just me. And, you know, I wasn't really listening to the people in there. And it was just, you know, not too good. But as I got older, like, the last time I got locked up was about, I think it was 07 or 08, in between that area. And I actually talked to an older guy. And now I'm actually, you know, starting to think about the things different. So, yeah, I did learn some good qualities in being in jail as I got older. But sitting in there, I was mostly, truth be told, to myself. I really didn't, I mean, I'm not the type to conversate with people, even though I'm actually conversating with everybody here. But
what about programs? Were there educational programs or programs on how to deal with issues in your life? You were saying some pretty serious things that happened in your family. Was there anyone to talk to you about that or give you training or education?
Believe it or not, there wasn't really no one there, believe it or not. I mean, my sisters has always been there, but even at that, my sisters are still there trying to get me, you know, on the right track. But it's just like at the time I was basically, how do you call it, I was hot-headed. So it was, you know, I really wasn't listening to nobody.
How about people within the prison? I mean, I know your family was there, but how about teachers or counselors or anybody that was there to help you deal with these things?
Truth be told, within the prison, I mean, there were people there. Yes, there was. But knowing me, I really didn't, I'm not the type to express my feelings to everybody. I mean, believe it or not, that took over time for me even to stand here in front of everybody now to actually talk about my life and what I went through. So it was actually, I mean, growing up, I really didn't talk to anybody, even if it was there. I had no, I mean, it wasn't me. But any other question?
No, no, that was good. I appreciate it. I appreciate that. So, Jerome, that's the last one. I wanted to be fair and ask everybody a question. You were saying that your mother had two jobs, right? And I wanted to ask you why she had two jobs. You know, why not one job? And then I'll ask the second question after that.
Okay, sure. Well, the reason my mother had two jobs was on the simple reason of that we was all cooped up in one big house. And she, I mean, of course, I mean, it's like you're 20-something with kids and you live with your mom, you still got to do by your mom's rules. You really don't want to do that. So she basically, she had four kids, so she had to take care of her kids the best way she could. So she worked two jobs. She was, I think, a mail carrier and a nurse. Or what they call it, for people that daycare. All right, yeah, that's what she did at daycare. But I mean, no matter how hard she tried to provide for her children and me and my siblings, I don't know, it struggled out hard for her even more. Like now, my mother, she's disabled. She had slipped this in her back, so. Still seeing somebody strive through a struggle and still end up in a struggle, that's a sorrowful sight to see. Like,
so that was the first part of the question. The second one was, we were talking earlier about how this war in Afghanistan is costing $100 million a day. Do you have any ideas of how that money, a small piece of that money, could have helped your mother and changed how hard she had to work in order to be able to take care of the four of you?
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, we'd love a piece of that money. So, but.
But how could they have gotten it to her? I mean, what ways could they do? You're in charge now.
Well,
you just took George Bush's place. Now you've got this $100 million. You're gonna start with your family, and then maybe everybody here, maybe some people here.
Well, I would, well, like, sponsoring Mirror Arts would be a good thing. Mirror Arts, like programs, like, they do have welfare, Section 8 and all types. They do have programs to help people, you know, but it's like you're still giving too many people. Like, the budgets is all wrong. Like, you giving us this type of money out of all these wealthy people, millionaires, mediocre families, and then you got your poor family. So if you sitting there, the poor family got this slice of the pie, and it's like it's more poor families than wealthy families. I mean, if you actually look at it, you got homeless people, you got people in the trains. You look around, you see a homeless person begging for change no matter what it is. So situation where it's like the government, I mean, the government is a bad situation. That's why, I don't vote. I'm not going to vote. It's like, the government is based off of war anyway. Like, we've been lied to. Look, like, I thought, like, knowledge, you know what I mean? You can't sit there and invest in something where you don't have no knowledge of. You can't tell somebody from the White House, the president sit there and just help bring money into a place he never even been to. He probably just walked through. So it's like, if you've never been in that situation, how can you help that situation? The only way to help that situation is actually like being in it or taking somebody who has been through it and letting them be that spokesperson or that idolized person for you. Like, because the government and violence, I'm sorry, I want to say this is off subject.
But
violence been here for years. That's how the government was, that's how the United States was built off of violence. So it's like we took over countries and we took over states by war. We never We never sat there and just said, all right, let's get together and let's become one big state. We took about war. And when you look at stuff like that, it's just a chain of command. So when you, if you sitting there taking things by war, somebody else is gonna look at you and be like, all right, well, he took it just like with a gun. Maybe I can do the same thing. So it's like we gotta have knowledge towards all things. And like they said, knowledge is power. But I don't know. Like the main thing is, we just gotta understand what's the purpose. We gotta understand what's the purpose. We should stick with one president, and one president has knowledge that can run this nation for a nice period of time, not just 4 or 8 years or whatever, because that's not long enough to sit there and change 500 million people. You can't change 500 million people's lives in 4 or 8 years. That's impossible. So, but like I said, like knowledge is the key. So, like, I mean, we've been lied to. Like, look at us now. Like, I came up with some studies and found out that George Washington wasn't even our first president. We had 6 presidents before that. Obama ain't the first black president either. Like, there's a lot of things we've been lied to about the tears, the Trail of Tears, all situations and stuff like that. I mean, it's just governments are basically a bit misleading. So I'm gonna just leave it at that.
Well, he was really dropping some knowledge there. I would refer you to the book by historian J.A. Rogers called The 5 Negro Presidents. So it might be some interesting read. I'm not referring to you because you've already checked it out. I'm just looking at you to give you credit for bringing it up. We might have a conversation with the next generation about the issue of voting and not vote for somebody that you don't like or vote for 2 parties you don't have respect for. But there are other smaller parties that are appearing on ballots that you might take a look at. And also, you can write in somebody. You can write in someone and register your protest rather than having them say, you know what, all those youth that didn't vote, they don't care. See, they didn't vote. If you write in a name, they say, oh, they voted, but they didn't vote for us. Maybe we need to figure out what he wants or she wants. So just an idea we'll talk about. Now, I don't want to leave you out. So the question for you is, $100 million a day. How many, I'm trying to ask a what or a how question, but I'll ask both. What could that money do to make opportunities available? So instead of having 4 youth here, we have one representative from, we have every youth who is in the city of Philadelphia who is interested in earning a salary and learning a skill. How far would that $100 million go?
Quick calculations. I can say we are funded by the federal government. Our grant from the Byrne Grant was a U.S. Department of Justice grant. It is $1.4 million for 3 years. And we hope to reach 40 youth a year, so that's 120 youth. So 100 times that, 1,200 we could reach. Plus, we would have more staff because we are always understaffed. We don't have enough people to do everything that we wanted to do. I get calls every day from different people, either people on probation, people coming out of prison, people working with people in these situations. They say, I have a client that's very talented in art. Do you have a program? And I have to turn down more people than I can accept because we don't have the funds to provide. We were very fortunate. I got a call from the Public Defenders Association. They have something called the Innocence Project. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. A man was got out of Graterford recently after spending 30 years there, was exonerated. He was spent 30 years for a murder, and he was exonerated of the crime. And he needed a job, and he couldn't find one. So he's working now in South Philadelphia putting up a mural. We're doing a mural about Julian Abel, who was the first black African-American architect to graduate from Penn. He helped design the art museum and some buildings at Duke. So if you go to 22nd and Morton, yeah, 22nd and Montrose, thank you, down in South Philly. There's going to be a beautiful mural there, and the guys were involved in that project too. But we could do a lot of work with $100 million that we can't do right now.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. And also we have to figure into the mix is the extra money that would be available when all of the people who are in your program don't go back to prison.
Oh.
So that might be enough for another 1,200 people right there.
Yeah, we could build a lot nicer prisons for people that do have to go there.
Right, right, right. Okay, so now, enough of the entertainment and the thinking. Now it's time for action. So what we'd like you to do is divide yourselves into how many groups? Huh? Okay, we said three or four, so let's say four. Four groups, just kind of gravitate into little circles, and we're going to have each of our panelists are going to join the groups, and we're going to have a conversation. We'll continue the personal testimonies, you can add your own reflections, but we also want to end up with a plan of action for resolving these issues of community violence, government violence in the domestic and in the Afghan setting. So, okay, folks, can everybody turn back this way? We're going to get some kind of report back from the groups. I think it's a good sign when folks don't just jump up and turn back around as soon as we say right away, okay, we're done. I think it means that you all were engaged. So, this is a chance to either report back or ask a question, or maybe both. We have a limited amount of time, but we really want to give you chances to express what went on. Any group like to start? Okay. What we're going to ask is for you to come up here because we want to get you on the microphone. Didn't know that was part of it, huh?
Marcus was with us, and me. I'm Celeste Zapala, and Marcus was with us in our little group. First of all, thanked him for being so brave to come out and talk tonight. And you know, after some discussion, one of the things that we all realized is that there's got to be somebody in your life who absolutely loves you and looks after you and takes care of you and follows you. And if that's not going to be somebody in your family, for whatever reason that's not going to be, there needs to be somebody who fulfills that role, because kids cannot raise themselves. And we were talking about an advocacy program of people who would be willing to be that person for a child. And the necessity of somebody within school systems or in social service who is willing to take that kind of responsibility. And one possible solution that we thought of was taking this program with the young men so willing to share so eloquently to teachers, to social workers who could hear your experiences and perhaps within their own profession begin to make some kinds of changes. Because one of the things that Marcus was telling us was that nobody, when he was in grade school, nobody was paying attention. He was in trouble, and nobody was paying attention within the school system, so there wasn't really anybody who was willing to help him as a young kid. And the necessity to kind of raise people's consciousness that somebody's got to be willing to step up for kids. And what else should we be saying? Right.
Would you repeat?
Why are we in these wars? And we agreed that it had a lot to do with making money, and we agreed that the prison system has a lot to do with making money, and you've got to have a constant supply of prisoners if you're going to make a great profit out of the prison system. Thank you.
Before you go. I just wanted to do a follow-up with you.
Okay.
I think that's a great idea to say that every young person who doesn't have somebody to give them love and guidance should have somebody. Right now, there aren't enough teachers and social workers probably to cover all the needs. So where are we going to get the resources for that?
Volunteers. I mean, we still have this program going, and we've been working with kids, and it's simply miraculous. It's keeping them out of jail, making them feel like they're in a real community, and in the same area, getting together with the youth advocates and their kids so that they feel that they have a family, an extended family.
Could you repeat that? Because I want.
We had talked about that advocacy program that took children. You took children into your home, right?
Yeah.
In high school, right?
Yeah, but that's not always necessary.
Right, but who were willing to, as volunteers, to assist kids and to be their advocates? And I would also make a plug as a former foster parent that even if it's only a couple of years that you can do it, there are so many children who need the, you know, a very basic home and someone to protect them, and that's a thought too, that sometimes you just have to put yourself on the line.
And just where I was trying to go with that is, remember, we have a pot of $100 million per day that's being spent on this war. And so some of my thinking, this is for the next group, so you'll know. When I say, so where are we going to get the resources from in order to carry this out so that everyone is able to do this? I'd like us to think outside of the box that we're limited to what we have right now and look at the fact that almost half of the annual budget of the United States is going towards war. And that should be a resource that we should be able to tap into. Next group.
Hi, my name is Michael Gagne. I work with Philadelphia Yearly Meeting and with Envision Peace Museum. I was in the group with Jerome, and Jerome, thank you for sharing with us. Jerome shared with us a bit more about his background and some of the things that were lacking in his home life and his community that led to him taking the path that he took. And some of these things, I took some notes, and some of these things can be addressed with very effectively with social programs, with a lot of the things that people in the room work on. We talked about places to go to be able to share, to express yourself, role models, guidance, security and livelihood and skills for livelihood. We talked about dreams and hope and the necessity of those, and also a sense of purpose and having something to live for. Jerome talked about when his daughter came on the scene, all of a sudden he found himself with a sense of clarity about what he was to do, how he wanted things to be different for his daughter. So we talked about the fact that there is this immense pool of resources that is going to war, and in some ways it's obvious, like why the question that seemed to resonate with our group is, how do we get the money out of the bad stuff and put it into the good stuff? And it kind of seems obvious, seems very simple. But of course, it's a big question. How do we do that? If it were so easy, maybe we would have done it already. But the money's there. And I think once we realize that and that it's not being used very well, we can put our minds to the task of strategy and figure out what has worked in the past in terms of a reallocation of resources. Now, our group didn't go there, but I'll just throw in and put my money on social movement, social struggle, and the willingness to disrupt business as usual. Something to think about.
Is there a second from the group? Is there a second?
Can I get an amen?
Now we're getting to the mother load.
And just when we talked about money, I was very happy that one member of our group at the end said, you know, it's not just about money. What about religion? What about spirituality? What about the church? And that it's not just, you know, the willingness and ability to throw money at a problem, but to say what is the alternative vision? Where is that sense of purpose coming from? And that can really allow a reorientation.
Thanks. I think I heard some description and some prescription. Yes.
I just want to add something. When you have more kids than you have homes that are open for them, friends meeting houses are great places two or three kids in five or six friends meetings around here living there with the contact of an advocate that was, you know, seeing the kids every day and taking responsibility. But it was a great opening for the meetings, too.
So she said when you have more kids than you have homes, there's always the friends meetings, and they have taken kids in. And the challenges to other religious groups as well. Okay, speaking of groups, we have one last group to report. In the interest of gender or racial diversity. Okay.
Hi, oops, I'm Bill Vanstone, and I'm retired, but I did work for a number of years with veterans. A lot of them had drug problems, and I think we did a nice job with them. But anyway, our group didn't quite solve the problems of Afghanistan, but we did started off with a question about, since the problem of drugs is here in the States, that's why all the wars are and the killing down in Mexico and so forth, Colombia, is to supply us with the drugs we need. What would a program look like that would be helpful to people who are about to go into get involved with drugs or have something like that? And our wonderful representatives here gave wonderful stories about how they had particularly essentially turned around young people who had were wondering, you know, what do? I go this way or that way? Or that? And what I summarize it is kind of like what you need for is someone like the first group, someone who cares, who's respected, who can give straight talk to these kids about what life is all about and where they ought to go. And I think also that people who have drugs need someone like that who can give them, like you guys have probably had that experience yourself, someone that cares. Anyway, go ahead.
What Paul and Raheem.
I couldn't remember.
What Paul and Raheem said is that they basically invested themselves into two young men in their lives, and that made a difference for those two young people. And so that is something that we have to, I think, really continue to do, is to people who have had those kinds of experiences in prison, or even if you haven't had an experience, is to continue to mentor and to, or be a mentor, get involved in some degree in someone's life. And the final comment that our group made, we were talking about the transformative nature of art, how we believe so much in what art can do for an individual, for a community. And as far as your question is concerned, because I know you're going to ask the question, it's about the money, is not only is there $100 million and then some available, but there's also $13 trillion available, from the way I see it, that has been given to corporations sitting in a bank somewhere. And so many of the executives of these corporations that we have so willingly cared for, those folks have received some kind of bonus, several bonuses. So I feel like that there's some money that we can somehow commandeer, for lack of a better word, and use to make a difference in the lives of our communities and the lives of our community members, people who need jobs, people who need education. And that's what I got to say.
Okay, so we had our charge. We were charged here to come and enjoy some artwork and then hear some great stories, some promising lives, and to put our heads together and begin to talk about what the prescription is. So I think, given the time, I think we did a pretty good job. And so I just want to, before we close, I just want to leave you with one thought, because the theme that I've been hearing is young people, young men like this, you know, have guidance in their lives and someone to love them and turn them around, you know, they can turn their lives around and make a difference. So I want to pose this question. What about the young people who, what did they have missing in their lives, and what guidance did they miss that led them to go out into the world and take massive amounts of money from people and to commit crimes all over the world? I mean, what about their upbringing? What about the love and the drug abuse in those families? I mean, gee, I haven't thought about that. I just assumed that there was love there. I mean, how could they, if they're the product of love, then how are they able to do all of this, wreck this havoc all over the world? And I think some of the conversation should be focusing on what those young people are missing that leads them to do this to the rest of the world. And with that, I'm going to throw it over to Peter.
Okay, great. Well, first, I want to thank you, King, and Robin, and in particular, Marcus, Paul, Jerome, Raheem. Thank you very much for coming. And we have one more week of this exhibit here in Philadelphia. So if you would like, we have postcards on the table near the exit. So grab a postcard and give it to a friend and encourage them to come. Next Friday, Friday, November 5th, we'll have six of the muralists who contributed paintings will be here talking about their work, what their idea was, and what they were trying to convey, and what it means to be part of an exhibit that is committed to social change. So next Friday, the 5th, from 7 to 9, the building will be open. And I also just want to say, I didn't draw attention to this earlier, but for those of you who have not been here before, the drawings against the wall here are from Afghan high school students, both girls and boys, that were collected over the summer, three different high schools in the city of Kabul. And they're pretty powerful. And I think they also send a message that we need to be thinking about. So thank you all for coming this evening. We have a few more minutes. Sadly, the building does close at 9, so they're going to be starting to flash the lights at us. But you still have a few more minutes if you want to ask one last question to our friends before we all leave. Sure.
While he's walking up, we have copies of a book that tells the stories of people on death row. And it's a beautifully bound book, and they're yours for the taking. Where are they?
Then the front.
On the way out. So help yourself. Help yourself to those.
Before we close everything out, once again, I want to thank the Quaker family for actually welcoming everybody here. And I just want to thank all of you for coming out today. And once again, thank you, Robin. You're great.
Thank you.